Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have with us today Robert Dineen, CFR Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies. Prior to coming to CFR, Dr. Dineen headed the Jerusalem mission of the Quartet Representative Tony Blair. A former career U.S. State Department official with over 20 years of Middle East experience, he previously served at the National Security Council and as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. Dr. Dineen is author of the CFR blog, Middle East Matters, as well as a recent policy innovation memo on ending Gaza's isolation, which we circulated in advance. He also tweets at Robert Dineen, so I hope you will follow him there. Robert, thanks very much for joining us today. It would be great if you could talk about the policy recommendations you outlined in your memo and where you see what assess our policy toward Gaza and what needs to change there. Robert?
Yes, well, thank you, Irina, and thank you for that, and welcome everyone, and thank you for your interest in this topic. Let me just, by way of introduction, say this memo, in a way, and the whole issue is something I've been intimately involved with. I was at the State Department and when Hamas took over Gaza in 2006, and we instituted the policy of isolation that is laid out. And I was in Jerusalem heading the Quartet mission in 2009 when Israel invaded Gaza and decided not to take out Hamas by force of arms in a way that many in Palestinian Authority had hoped Israel would do. And I had a lot of conversations with Palestinians in the West Bank, with Israeli security officials. I've been to Gaza. I was the last American diplomat to go to Gaza. And what I saw was a situation that is quite unusual and led me to a lot of conclusions that that surprised me. In many ways, you know, the policy that was put in place in 2006 were the so-called quartet conditions that, you know, under only certain circumstances would we talk to Hamas if they recognize Israel, if they recognize previous agreements, if they forswear violence. That was really then combined with an approach that was meant to isolate Gaza. And the unspoken part of that policy was an effort to isolate Hamas with the hope that if you have, on the one hand, a West Bank that is flourishing and booming economically, that is making peace with Israel, that then, and in contrast, you have a Gaza where it's internationally isolated, economically isolated, and people are miserable, you'll create a situation where those contradictions will force an outcome that leads to the overthrow of Hamas in Gaza. And what we saw in 2009 was, first of all, that didn't happen. The situation in Gaza did get miserable, but never so much so that it led people to overthrow Hamas. And when Israel went in 2009, it chose not to take out Hamas. And that was really the opportunity. And in conversations with Israeli officials, I learned, you know, I asked them, well, why didn't you take out Hamas? And the answer was because we didn't want to. It wasn't because the reason that most people assumed at the time, which was that Israel was scared of its taking casualties. It was more that Israel was concerned about the power vacuum that would ensue if Hamas was removed. So what I wanted to try to do was, first of all, frame the discussion about Hamas and about Gaza away from the traditional one, which tends to be, you know, should we talk to Hamas or shouldn't we? Which I frankly find to be kind of a side issue. I mean, I think it's a secondary issue in the way that, you know, there was a long time of debate whether we should talk to Muslim Brotherhood or not in Egypt. Well, as we've learned, we talked to them and it had no effect. So it's really a secondary issue. Secondly, I wanted to to show that, you know, when we tend to talk about Gaza and Hamas synonymously, and we shouldn't. Hamas rules Gaza, but the majority of Gazans don't like Hamas and don't want Hamas there. And while we are using a very blunt instrument, we, being the international community, and that includes Egypt, that includes Israel, and it includes the Palestinian Authority to a certain extent, in all isolating Hamas in a way that serves a very short-term interest but seems to work against the longer-term objective of a two-state solution. And the odd situation is that the isolation actually plays to Hamas's advantage, because it set up an alternative economy that that benefits Hamas, and it's hurt the legitimate businesses and civil society and the whole middle class in Gaza, who feel very much vulnerable to Hamas. They have to pay certain homage to Hamas, but would like nothing more to see Hamas removed. And so, you know, now we have peace negotiations, and we taking place between Israel and part of Palestine, or part of the Palestinian Authority, that part which controls the West Bank. And there's somehow we assume away Gaza as if this is a problem that can be dealt with later. And the problem is that it's a problem that will then come back with a vengeance, because now Hamas is feeling weakened, feeling vulnerable, and it has to a certain extent, it has a double veto over the peace process. One, it can initiate violence, and that's something that in talking to Israeli negotiators that were here in Washington last week, they're extremely concerned about. They're worried that Hamas is going to blow up the negotiations by initiating violence. When that happens, that puts the onus on Israel to either retaliate, which then puts the pressure on the Palestinian negotiators to have to walk from the table, or else they'll be accused of being insensitive to Palestinian needs. And then basically Hamas wins. They've thwarted the peace process. Or a second outcome is that you can have negotiations that will produce an agreement, and then Hamas, having been outside this process, will say, we reject it. It's a sellout. No matter how good it is, a deal for the Palestinians, it will never be good enough for the rejectionists. So they have they continue to have a veto. And so it seems to me that the only way you're really going to have a empowered Palestinian negotiator that can actually close a deal with Israel is one that reconciles these internal differences in between Fatah and Hamas. The problem is that neither Fatah nor Hamas really want to reconcile. The Palestinian people want them to, but both are too entrenched in their positions and have really no incentive to move from it. So what I tried to propose were some ideas that would actually weaken Hamas's grip on Gaza in a way that strengthens those Palestinians that are moderates, that do want to reconcile with Israel through diplomacy, and in doing so could help to break this lock on Gaza and that Hamas has, and this veto that Hamas has then over the peace process. And so then I go into some recommendations about that are pretty mild, frankly. I don't subscribe or recommend necessarily in this. I definitely don't recommend in this document that we talk to Hamas, we being the West or the Quartet. They'll pocket that as a victory of sorts. I don't think it would do much harm, but I don't think it would help either. So it would be a political payoff that has little. For Hamas and no political payoff for us. But what I suggest is, you know, first of all, that we restore trade links between the PA in the West Bank with Gaza, and then thereby trying to break the lock that Hamas has on trade and a source of revenue for Hamas. Secondly, a transit corridor, because now between the West Bank and Gaza, something that had been established, had been negotiated between Israel and the Palestinians, a safe passage agreement between the West Bank and Gaza, because now you have a situation where the people of Gaza and the people of the West Bank are becoming estranged. And again, if the goal is to have a Palestinian state, then you can't have a situation where the two halves of the state don't have any contact with one another. And moreover, that contact is likely to help further undermine Hamas, because the more that Gazans are able to go to the West Bank and see the better lifestyle, conditions, economic situation, the more frustrated and angry they're going to be about Hamas. And the more they're going to tell people in the West Bank, the more that people in the West Bank are going to be exposed to just how bad Hamas has been in Gaza. And so their, you know, exposure is the best antidote. The third recommendation was ultimately to promote a contact group to help promote Palestinian elections, because here the Palestinians haven't had elections since 2006, and so you know what we really have is a sclerosis within the Palestinian polity and Palestinian political institutions losing legitimacy and thereby weakening the President Abbas's ability to really close the deal, in my analysis. And finally, what I propose is that together with the Europeans, that we help put together a regional contact group that's going to help prepare the PA for elections. In essence, here what I'm trying to do is level the playing field, because Hamas has local allies, namely Turkey and Qatar. They've lost Egypt now, but they still have very powerful allies that are promoting their interests because we won't talk to them. But what I'd like to do is see some of the other countries in the Arab world who do have proper and formal contact with Hamas but are no fans also be included. So you bring in Jordan, you bring in the Emiratis, you bring in other Arabs who are more favorably disposed towards the Palestinian Authority, and then you could have a more balanced group that engages Hamas and brings those two sides together and ultimately forces or encourages Hamas to abandon terrorism and violence as a ticket into the political process. Because what we've seen at the end of the day is Hamas is not going to be defeated militarily, and therefore, if it's going to be part of this, or if it's not going to be part of it, it's going to be a exercise of veto on political progress. And if that's the goal, a Palestinian state and a two-state solution, and that is the goal, as is articulated daily by our administration and the negotiators themselves, then this is going to be a necessary part of it.
Terrific.
Hello?
Okay, yes.
Sorry. I was afraid I lost you.
No, still here. Let's open up for questions and comments from the group.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the 1 key, that's star 1, on your touch-tone phone now. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first question comes from Jake Bennett with AJC.
Thank you, Mr. Dennett. My question, and I'm speaking on my own behalf, not on behalf of the AJC. We talk a lot about the goal being a two-state solution, but I think really the goal is peace for the people living in the area. And since Gaza seems to have such a strong veto power on a solution of peace, why aren't we talking about a three-state solution? If Abbas is willing to make peace with Israel from the West Bank, and that could be its own polity, then why not leave Gaza and Israel to work things out separately? And the idea that there has to be one unified Palestine, I think is wrong-headed and not necessary. Gaza voted 70% for Hamas in 2006, so they voted with where they want to be. And where they vote now, I don't know. I've seen recent polls. But the idea of setting up a corridor between Gaza and the West Bank seems dangerous to say the least. And you could be exporting military arms and militant ideas. And it seems like that would be poison to the peace process. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you. Well, first of all, I agree with you. The point is peace, and as the parties have identified, end of conflict, end of claims. I don't think there is such a thing as a three-state solution. First of all, I've yet to meet a Palestinian who would endorse it, at least formally. As it is, the West Bank and Gaza as comprised constitute 22% of historic Palestine. They're not going to, west of the Jordan River, they're not going to take less than that. And so a West Bank statelet is not going to lead to a end of conflict, end of claims, which is what Israel really needs. I mean, at the end of the day, Israel needs for there to be a durable and lasting peace, the end of claims, because that means the end of the Palestinian refugee problem, which has been at the, you know, one of the core friction points since the 1948 war. So if you want Israel to give up the territory, then they should benefit from the comprehensive peace that would come from it, it seems to me. Secondly, all you're doing then is creating a festering sore that is Gaza that is just going to be a source of endless friction and violence and tension, a revanchist entity. I mean, Egypt doesn't want to take control of it. Israel doesn't want control of it. So who is, you know, it's not going to exist on its own. And all it becomes is a ward of the international community, and it is, which it is to a certain extent already. As for polling, the polling for Gaza, I mean, Hamas polls very badly in Gaza, I think somewhere in the 20s, because the fact of the matter is Hamas rule has disenchanted the population towards Hamas, just as it did in Egypt towards the Muslim Brotherhood. So I don't think that's the danger. What I've proposed is audacious. It's ambitious. I am trying to shake it up, because the while there are some dangers in the or risks incumbent on any change, the status quo is to me a bad for Israel and bad for moderate Palestinians. It's hard to see where any positive progress is going to come from the situation as it obtains today. So, you know, you can quibble with some of my recommendations, but I think the analysis is one that I know Israeli security officials who've seen this document have welcomed, as have, you know, American security officials. You know, and PA as well. So, I mean, everyone agrees that the situation as it exists is no good. I mean, the reality is that the what keeps it going is a certain degree of bureaucratic inertia and the political price of change. I mean, up until the Gilad Shalit release, no one in Israel wanted to touch the situation in Gaza because of the conflation of Hamas and Gaza. If you're helping Gaza, then you're seen as helping Hamas. What I'm trying to show is you can actually help hurt Hamas by helping Gaza. And there, I think that you know, some of the ideas that I've put forward are a means toward that end.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul Tavares from New York Divinity School.
I appreciate the perspective that you bring, Dr. Dannon. I had breakfast with the senior pastor of, I think, the only Protestant church in Gaza just last week, and he was sharing with me how many families are wanting to leave Gaza in spite of, you know, living there all their lives because of increasing oppression against in his opinion, Christians in particular, maybe other groups as well. What do you see as a perspective on persecution against Christians in the near term? And also, how can people in America speak up, do something that would help protect lives and reduce this loss? I think if all these Christians leave Gaza, there would be some less balance even after that.
Well, First of all, I think the persecution of Christians is a region-wide phenomenon, and you're seeing a regional exodus. That is, throughout the Middle East, Christians are leaving, be it from Iraq, be it from Jordan, be it from even Lebanon, and for sure from Egypt. And Islamism and greater religious intolerance is fueling it. Hamas's takeover in Gaza has been a disaster for Christians. These are not benevolent or tolerant people. I think the prospects for Christians in Gaza under Hamas is very poor and likely to get worse. What can be done about it is, I think you know, short of ridding Gaza of Hamas and you know, the only palliative I can think of is simply to bring these issues to public light so that people have no illusions about what it is that they're dealing with, because I think there are illusions at times that if we just sit down and talk to these people, then we can come to some sort of modus vivendi. And you know, as a former diplomat that was spent over 20 years, there is a time and place for diplomacy, and there's a time and place for negotiations. And there will be a time, I believe, that we should sit down with Hamas, but not until they, you know, not until they make some fundamental changes. And I don't see those happening, at least in the short term. But I think, at a minimum, we need to have greater awareness of the sorts of things that they are doing in Gaza that we find unconscionable and intolerable.
Am I still on here?
Yes, you are.
Maybe a quick follow-up. It does disappoint me that what I listen to and learn so tremendously from these conversations with the Council on Foreign Relations, hardly any of it seems to matter to mainstream media. It seems like two different worlds. Do you have any suggestions on how the council maybe could grab some more attention in the media, or what could be done? Because I think people are ignorant of the oppression of many religious minorities, and obviously Christian minorities have a lot of special interest to many Christians in America. But why the missing pieces in the mainstream media's coverage?
I have to profess I don't even know how to attack that question. All I can say is I did a media call last week on this topic. We had close to 100 people on that call. So we're doing our best to get the message out and to try to provide the nuance to an issue that tends to be framed in very black and white terms.
All right. Well, thank you.
To that end, we do have a lot of our fellows appearing on the major news outlets and are, having, as Robert said, the journalist briefings and those kinds of things. But in the age of the Internet, it's a big world out there. Let's take the next question.
I think your next question comes from David Wildman with United Methodist Church.
Hello, this is David. Thanks for the discussion. I want to just ask for some comments on what I feel has not been a critical piece of this whole thing around Gaza, and that is the role of the international community and the U.S. and the Israeli governments around a blockade of a civilian population. Groups like Christian Aid and Oxfam and Amnesty International have said this was a humanitarian crisis that's been created by political actions of squeezing the imports and exports of a civilian population, half of whom are under 18. The World Bank has said that private sector can't exist because of the blockade. There's no exports. And to me, you've made no mention of the role of the international community and U.S. policies of blocking it. And in fact, if you look at a definition of terrorism, the targeting of a civilian population for political outcomes, such as changing their government, is the same definition as terrorism. So I'm wondering if you could say something about the responsibilities of of all of the governments and international community for the humanitarian well-being of the civilian population there in relation to Hamas. And then the second piece to that is just, you mentioned at the very beginning, and I just wasn't sure if this was a confusion or not, the Hamas takeover in 2006. My recollection was January 2007. I just put it in June of 2007 because the election was a democratically elected, whatever we think of Hamas, they were,
yes, sir.
You know,
correct.
Elected. And I was at some of the
correct.
Polls, there were Christians that voted
correct.
For Hamas to get the corrupt Fatah leadership out. And it wasn't that they at all endorsed, you know, Hamas.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
So I'll go ahead and
comment on the international community and the humanitarian crisis. I'd really appreciate that.
Sure. Well, I have to say, sir, this sort of use of some of the heated rhetoric and state-sponsored terrorism and all that, not all that helpful. What I try to do is, in my approach is actually denude the conversation of such heated terms and really deal with it in a little more lower-key way. You know, what I thought I was trying to address was, boldly say, the whole international approach to Gaza has been a failed one. So we can talk about rights. What I tried to address is sort of what is smart. Because I find too much of the discussion about Israel-Palestine focuses on rights, and that's appropriate, but it doesn't get us to solutions. I was trying to work with a solution-based approach that said the current approach was not working by any measure, so it made no sense even by the measure of the people instituting it. Now, you know, if we want to get into the whole issue of the blockade and its effect, I mean, the reality is, as someone who's gone to Gaza, is surprisingly mixed. The reality is you can buy anything in Gaza today. The tunnel economy has been produced an alternative economy that that does leave many people hurting, but many people doing very, very well. And so it's really a resource allocation issue. But, you know, frankly, we have people who go to Gaza in order to buy goods at a cheaper price than they can be found in Israel or in the West Bank. So the idea of this kind of caricature view of Gaza as simply this sea of squalor is only partially correct. So more accurately, the way in which Gaza is blockaded has produced gross economic distortions that ultimately benefits Hamas and hurts the civilian population. Does that have humanitarian ramifications? Yeah, for sure. And all the, you know, but again, that wasn't the focus of my approach. Was not to focus on the humanitarian plight of however right that is and legitimate. The focus is more trying to look at the macro policy that the U.S. has instituted, and which is one of isolation, and say, this is not advancing our objective.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Layla Almoradi with Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Hello.
Layla, your line is open.
Is my line open? Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Well, first I want to thank you for your comments and for your interesting proposal. I happen to have just come from Gaza. I was there in April. I have relatives living in the southern part of the Gaza Strip in Khan Yunis, and then I have been there in 2009 shortly after Operation Cast Lead. So, you know, I've had a chance to see the situation and agree with what you said about how there is a distortion of people who have somehow benefited from the current situation and others who have suffered tremendously. You can't overestimate how bad the situation is, I don't think. And it's not using dramatic language to make that point either. It's when you sort of witness it firsthand in terms of what the conditions are in some of the more poorer areas of the Gaza Strip. And I believe the situation is going to get much worse now that, you know, the current Egyptian government has destroyed and blocked many of the tunnels because, as you stated, that's how people have managed to get by despite the blockade. And the fact that this has been going on for so long is partly related to the over-identification of all Gazans with Hamas, with an Islamist agenda, and the ultimate dehumanization of the population, which makes this policy of collective punishment palatable to the rest of the world. Even after Gilad Shalit was released, people thought that was going to have some change, but it really didn't, and we're left in the situation where we are now, which is really devastating for the people that live there, who do not support the current regime, definitely did not support the Fatah government. I don't know that they would welcome them back in at this point, considering, you know, their track record in Gaza. But my one thing that was really struck me when I was there was the number of Israeli goods on the shelves in the markets in Gaza City and throughout. And the fact that it benefits Israel to have this population that is forced to consume Israeli goods economically. I also witnessed this at one point in the northern part of the West Bank, where it was in Israel's interest to cut off the burgeoning relationship between the Palestinians living in Nazareth and other parts of Israel and the Palestinians in, say, Jenin area. And so I'm wondering, well, how motivated are they really to change the situation to benefit the Palestinians economically? I totally concur with the idea of a corridor. Palestinians are a unified people. There are a lot of people who've married across from, you know, they have relatives in Nablus or Gaza. They should be able to connect with them, and you should be able to, you know, make the proper provisions with respect to security without, again, collectively punishing the entire population. But I'm just curious what your sense is as a diplomat, what would be in former. Israel's interest to change that as a former diplomat, but based on your experience,
yeah.
What would be in their interest to change that equation when it seems to be in their interest, especially economically?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, thank you. I agree with everything you said. And again, my apologies to the previous caller. I think the situation is so awful in and of itself that, in a way, I don't think it doesn't need any adornment with any additional sort of heated adjectives. And so, you know, a more clinical approach, I think, just allows us to have a freer conversation. I think, you know, your characterization is exactly right. You know, I think the problem is, as I experienced in you know, look, I spent 2.5 years heading the Quartet mission trying to work shuttle between Israeli and Palestinian officials to try to ameliorate the economic situation on the West Bank and to the extent possible on in Gaza. And what you discover is, you know, in once you do that, and having been a diplomat working with, you know, high policy either at the NSC or at the State Department, that, you know, once you get down onto the ground, you can no longer talk about kind of monolithic interests here. And so you may have a state interest, you may have then certain sub-group communities of be it business communities, be it the military, be it all sorts of different constituencies. What I came to, you know, with my conclusion, having especially even prior to that job, when because I worked on as a deputy assistant secretary in 2000, between 2006 and 2008, I spent a good deal of time shuttling between Israel and Egypt to try to work on the issue of the tunnels. And, you know, I'd say, you know, here your analysis on comparing the economic cooperation, the situation between sort of Jenin and Nazareth on the one hand and then sort of the Gaza context, is they're two wholly separate realities and different sort of political environments and that lead to totally different approaches. I mean, so to be specific, when it comes to Gaza, I mean, I think Israel, there may be some Israeli commercial ventures that benefit from selling goods into Gaza. I'm sure. And, you know, you can find Israeli products in the Gulf or in Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's, you know, you can then extrapolate political conclusions. Businessmen and women will sell where they can sell. The reality is, I think Israel wants as little, you know, Israel evacuated Gaza in 2005 and basically hoped that Egypt, if anyone, would take responsibility for Gaza. At the same time, Egypt basically said, no, we're not playing. It's, you occupied it in 67, we don't want it back. Too many headaches associated with it. And to a certain extent, Gaza has been the orphan that no one wants, neither Israel nor Gaza. the one party that does want it or should want it is the Palestinians themselves. And so that's why, you know, that's why it seems to me the only logical approach is the one I laid out. But you know, the reality is Israel doesn't want to go back into Gaza. It doesn't even like the fact that it has to. It, to a certain extent, the humanitarian burden falls on it, and it's getting worse, especially now since the coup in Egypt. Has led the military in Egypt to take an even harsher approach to Gaza than the Brotherhood had taken towards Gaza, which was still pretty harsh and unexpected given the ideological affinities between the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Hamas. You know, when it comes to the West Bank and trade between Israel and the West Bank, it's very complicated. I helped open up trade between Jalameh between Nazareth and Jenin. It meant overcoming a lot of vested interests on both sides. Israeli and Palestinians left to their own devices business and will find ways to work with each other despite whatever the politics of the reality of the situation is. And so, the West Bank is a very fertile economic backyard for Israeli products, and Israel benefits a great deal from that. But I don't think that's a driving factor, really, in sort of driving Israeli policies overall, because I think that at the end of the day, in terms of the Israeli economy, the West Bank is pretty minuscule, and Gaza is infinitesimal when it comes to the Israeli national economy, even though from the reverse point of view, from a Palestinian point of view, Israel plays a dominant role in its economy, given the disparities in size.
I guess just to follow up, you know, the most difficult thing, you know, when you're there, you realize, given all of that, and given how small it is, and how insignificant it is, and how easy it is for either Israel to blockade, the borders, for Egypt to close it, that they really do not have control over their lives, over their future, but yet they have such a strong desire to make life better for themselves and their children, and they have zero leverage when it comes to, you know, on to me at least, and as observer of the political process, to making their situation better from a bigger picture point of view, and so it sometimes can feel extremely hopeless, and that's why I was encouraged by what you wrote, that hopefully somebody else will agree, because it's a sign that at least there could be some future for the people there.
Well, see, what struck me especially is because I've dealt with a lot of Gazans, when I was in Jerusalem, hanging the quartet, we set up just regular, when I couldn't go to Gaza, just regular teleconferences. Because I think what I found to be, you know, the political ramification of the policy as it exists now is not as much as, you know, what I didn't say. I point to the disaffection that exists between from Gazans towards Hamas, but that doesn't translate into support for Fatah or even support for anyone. I think that there's such political alienation in Gaza today, and a sense that they've been, you know, from Gazans that basically of abandonment and political apathy and hopelessness, and that just fuels the status quo rather than leads to any change. I just don't see where the status quo leads to a better outcome in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
To ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Natalie Hotby Hayden with George Washington University. Natalie, the line is open.
My question is in relation to your blog post from last week about prioritizing issues in the Middle East and where should Secretary Kerry spend his time and effort. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how what's going on in Gaza relates to that list of all the critical things that are going on, and where you would place this on the Secretary's priority list, and if not him, who?
Well, that is sort of, I'll answer it, but it is a bit sort of beyond the scope of the conversation, on the one hand, you have the Secretary of State has identified making peace between Israel and the Palestinians, you know, his number one priority. I think that's pretty clear. And if that's the case, then, you know, then I think the situation in Gaza is a major, I hate to use this term, but, you know, is the elephant in the room that no one wants to deal with. And yet, it seems like a fatal omission to his efforts. I know people in the State Department are extremely receptive to what I've written, but at the same time, they don't see, I think it's politically very difficult for them to see how to weave that in. Yet, you know, that's the beauty of having left the State Department and the government, is you can say, you know, kind of, you can step back and sort of look with one step back and say, the road you're on makes no sense. And frankly, the road they're on, to me, does not, makes no sense if they don't factor in the situation in Gaza, which can, as I tried to lay out in my earlier remarks, can exercise a veto over all that they're trying to do. But the question you really asked was, okay, so then, therefore, you have this problem between Israel and Palestine, and how do you fit it into a larger regional context when you've got Egypt, you know, going through a counter-revolution, a post-coup reality with, you know, potential violence. You have a horrific civil war where over 100,000 people have been killed in Syria, great regional instability. You know, those are, prioritizing that all is, you know, is a bit, you know, is challenging. He's come to a conclusion that his analysis is really not so much born of that there's such a strategic opportunity between Israel and Palestine, as much as if he doesn't deal with this in the next, this is what he said on the Hill, before the Senate, you know, the window is going to close between 18 to 24 months. Those were the Secretary of State's words. And so it's more a sense that if he doesn't reach, if, you know, don't broker peace soon, then the window closes. I'm not as pessimistic as that. I think that there are urgent humanitarian needs. I think Israel needs the peace. Palestine needs the peace. You know, but when you start talking about how to prioritize competing needs in the world, you know, this starts to get into questions of grand strategy. And I just think it's, I tried to flag the question because it's an important one to consider. But it, you know, you know, whether the Secretary of State should be spending more time in Egypt and less time in Israel and Palestine, you know, I was trying to at least flag it as an issue. But I'm loath to be to weigh in too heavily on one side or another on that.
So if I could follow up on that, because it does seem to me you're absolutely right. It makes perfect sense to me that this is something that also needs to be dealt with in the midst of all those other priorities as well, too. Is there somebody else, or is this an opportunity? Our policies around America, is it only, I guess, Israel that should open up trade relations, or should other nations, countries, groups, businesses do that as well, too? And is there a way to embrace that as a part of a larger policy that or strategy toward Gaza?
Well, you know, this was a, you know, this is a political, I mean, my piece was political. I'm not, you know, advocating opening up Gaza in order to make it, you know, just as a palliative to the horrific economic conditions there. It's with a very specific economic political goal, which is to see which is to have the situation in Gaza sort of align with declared U.S. policy objectives. And here, the policy objective is to see a Palestinian state that living side by side in peace and security with a, you know, safe and secure Israel. How do we get there? The first step, it seems to me, was to fix what had been broken, which is the ties that had existed between both sides, you know, between the West Bank and Gaza. Why is Israel the key? Israel is the key because Israel is the occupying power in the West Bank, because Israel is the territory that physically exists between the West Bank and Gaza. It still has legal obligations under international law for the situation in Gaza, even though it evacuated its military and settlements from Gaza. It still controls the sea and airspace and is considered under international law the occupying power still. So it has certain legal obligations that even the Israeli, you know, the foreign ministry's legal division does not challenge. So, you know, it's a reality. Again, there's a danger here in what I'm advocating. I acknowledge that. I don't want to see, you know, a thriving Islamist state on the Mediterranean that can be a model for, you know, upheaval elsewhere in the region. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not adverse to picking sides. I want to see, you know, I think the United States wants to see moderate, pro-democracy, pro-Western forces emerge here, and the question is how do we support our friends? This policy is not supporting our friends, and part of that is to say that we actually have friends in Gaza too, the majority of whom, you know, many of whom, some of whom, you know, at least have lived in the United States, have come to the United States, who abhor what is happening to their society. So it's with that in mind that I tried to design a policy, or at least advocate a policy, and at a minimum a policy critique, to say what we're doing now is working against what we're trying to do, not in support of what we're trying to do. And that, to me, just makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's very helpful. So appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question here comes from Darius Makuja with Des Moines College.
Hello. Yeah, I'm Darius from Syracuse, New York. I'm trying to see, well, you have a wonderful presentation, but I have the difficulty of how the West kind of deal with the seemingly dictatorial fundamentalist groups around the world in a rather sympathetic manner, because they are simply democratically elected, and yet the voices of the oppressed people, be it Christians, and in this case, particularly in the Sudan, Egypt, nobody seems to pay attention to the sovereign few who eventually don't have a sympathy. How do you combine that? How do you navigate this situation for a common person, a lay person out there on the streets?
I'm sorry, sir. I'm having a little trouble just with the phone. So could you just clarify the specific question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the specific question that I have is just your comment on how the West views fundamentalist groups that become the governments, while at the same time these groups oppress the minorities, be it Christians, and yet the West seems to be very sympathetic in trying to sort out their issues. Meanwhile, on the other hand, those persecuted in these same governments seem not to have a sympathetic view from the West. How do you comment on that?
Well, that's not the. I guess I don't share that analysis. I don't think that, you know, that the United States has a particular view on so-called fundamentalist government. I don't think that's what the issue is, be it in Egypt or elsewhere. You know, the concern is about groups that take power that are use democratic means towards ultimately anti-democratic ends, that then try to use the rule of law in order to subvert the rule of law, and you know, in the case of however challenging the situation is in Egypt, in Gaza it's much less so. Here you have a group that on the one hand purports to be a government, but also is a terrorist organization that keeps has its own subnational militia. Groups like Hamas, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, are both political parties and yet have their own private militias. that doesn't that goes against, you know, the basic concept of what a state is. A state is a polity that has a control over the monopoly over the force of arms. And in the case of Palestine, that's not the case today. You don't have a monopoly of force of arms under the control of a democratically elected president. It's true, Hamas was elected to the parliament in 2006, there's been the violent takeover of Gaza by Hamas in 2007 that then kicked out the PA. Military in favor of Hamas's militia, you know, was not. So we're now in a very complicated realm. The goal is to try to reinstitute a single unified national authority that has is politically in control of all the territory and exercises a monopoly on the force of arms. We don't have that today. We have a Palestinian authority that has been trained and disciplined and is now answerable to civilian rule in the West Bank, and then you have Hamas in Gaza, which has not, you know, renounced violence and terrorism, which still continues to lob rockets into Israel without provocation, which is not to speak about Israel's retaliations. But, you know, I don't think that the reason that the European Union also doesn't talk to Hamas is legal. I mean, there are legal prescriptions against it that happening because of the designation of Hamas based on its actions. It's not about fundamentalism. It's about certain basic precepts that have to do with the rule of law.
Thank you.
Robert, unfortunately, I think we're close to the end of our time. I'm sorry to all of those who are still have questions, but I wanted to give you the opportunity just to do a wrap-up before we close the call, Robert.
Well, thank you. No, I mean, I appreciate all of your questions and all of your interest. And again, just to sum up, I don't profess to have all the answers or to suggest that the policy recommendations are 100% spot on. But I think the basic analysis that suggests that the status quo does not benefit anyone other than Hamas, I'm confident of, and I my experience has been talking to Palestinian officials in the West Bank, to Israeli officials in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, that the obstacles to changing it, and to American officials here throughout the White House, the State Department, elsewhere, the problems are political, not strategic, and are largely that of inertia. Again, I was there when we designed the policy. I was there to help implement it, and there comes a time when you have to say, does the policy that was designed to serve one objective still make sense when the objective has changed? We put in this policy as a way to try to overthrow Hamas, and it was based on an analysis that said that they would be by sort of starving Gaza, not literally, but all sorts of sanctions are effectively meant to use to produce a political outcome. That political outcome not only is not going to happen, but it's no longer sought, at least by the parties in the region. And so the question is, what will work? And there, at least at a minimum, I was trying to spark a informed policy debate that suggests that we at least start thinking about other means instead of just assuming away a problem that because it doesn't get a lot of attention, everyone thinks is okay when it really isn't.
Thank you very much, Robert. We really appreciate your sharing your insights with us today and the policy recommendations as you outlined in your policy innovation memo. Thanks to everyone for your questions and comments. As a reminder, you can read more on this issue and others by visiting Robert Dineen's blog, Middle East Matters, at www.cfr.org. And as I mentioned at the outset, follow him on Twitter, at Robert Dineen. So thank you. As you know,
thank you, everybody.
Yes, and as you know, this conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, which seeks to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars in cross-denominational conversations on a broad range of pressing international issues. Any feedback or suggestions you'd like to send to us, please email us at outreach@cfr.org. So thank you all again, and hope you enjoy the hot days of August.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.